Okay, we'll move to the second section of part one, and I've entitled it Coping with Uncertainty. Ecclesiastes 4:17. Watch how you behave when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is more acceptable than the sacrifice offered by fools, for they're not aware of the evil they are doing. Plenty in the prophets about sacrifice, nothing wrong with sacrifice, but it has to come out of a genuine heart. And he goes on, never be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be quick to utter a word to God. For God's in heaven and you're on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For as a dream comes with many cares, so a fool's voice comes with many words. And I was reminded of Jesus' statement, when you're praying, he said to his apostles, don't heap up empty phrases the way the Gentiles do. They think they'll be heard because of their many words. And Kohelet continues, when you make a vow to God, don't delay fulfilling it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill what you vow. Better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not fulfill it. Don't let your mouth lead you into sin. Don't say in God's presence that it was a mistake, lest God be angry at your words and destroy the work of your hands. There's an abundance of empty dreams. There are words aplenty, but for you, fear God. Well, I promised you last week I'd spend some time with you on what does fear of God mean in the biblical tradition. You'll find all this not in the commentary on the festival scrolls, but the other book there on Proverbs and Job, pages 9 to 10. This is all done out carefully. I'll do it with you now, though, vocally. So our aim is to see, because they're always talking about fear of the Lord, fear of Yahweh, fear of God. What do they mean is my aim now. Well, the first thing to think about when we hear the expression in the Old Testament, we've got a different view in the New, I think, but in the Old is, this fear of God is seen as a gift from God. And we've got a problem here about languages. Fear of God. It's the genitive. There's no word for of in the Hebrew or the Greek. So fear, it's the kind of fear they're talking about is the fear related to God. When I say fear of God, it sounds like it could mean God is the object of the fear. God's the one you're afraid of. It doesn't exclude that because it's a genitive. But it could be fear that comes from God as a gift. And it could be fear of quite a lot of things. So we've got to remember the genitive is in itself all-inclusive. It's not specific enough. They could say fear for God, fear from God. There's all those possibilities in those languages. This is just a genitive. So what does it mean? Firstly, it's a gift. So if it's a gift from God, it's probably something good. Now let's have a look at it. I'll read you from Isaiah. The spirit of Yahweh will rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, spirit of knowledge and fear of Yahweh. And then it accents that. His delight will be in the fear of the Lord or the fear of Yahweh. So in the Hebrew, there are actually only six gifts, not seven. When you get into the Septuagint, it adds a seventh, piety. a very important virtue in the Roman world, pietas. So it's that's added in to make up the seven. But there's only six in the Hebrew, and fear of Yahweh is stressed as this very important gift from God. Here's some texts, and one of the key things in the Bible, in the Hebrew poetry, is explanation by repetition from a different angle. You'll often have two lines of poetry. The second says the same as the first, but uses a different image to help you enter into, connect with the insight, because words can never quite catch it. So we'll see a little bit of that now. The fear of Yahweh, says Psalm 111, verse 10, is the beginning of wisdom. So it's right at the very core of it. It's the beginning. Without that, you'll never get wise. Psalm 112, verse 1 says, happy are those who fear Yahweh. Next line, which explains it, those who greatly delight in his commandments. So to delight in God's commandments equals to fear God. Taking God really seriously, thanking God that God has made clear for us what we are to do in the Ten Commandments or wherever you are. I'm talking as a Jew now. And finally, as Christians, we've got a wonderful thing, come follow me. We've got this extraordinary thing about Christianity that our basis isn't a book, in spite of people who think it is. The book is an expression of what was picked up from a person. And our faith is based on a person, which of course is wonderful because you can't lock it into covers and control it, a person. So and Jesus says, come and follow me. So following him is the command. And then Jesus, of course, John and the other beloved disciples, words on that later and says, I have one commandment to give you. And it's not an extra one, it's one that covers everything. Love one another with my love, is really what he's saying, as I have loved you. But let's leave that for a minute and go back to the Jewish world. Delighting, they were delighted because God had revealed to them what to do and how to live a good life. What a gift. Fearing God is taking that seriously and living accordingly. Psalm 128 verses 1 to 4 reads, happy is everyone who fears Yahweh. Doesn't mean in itself being frightened of Yahweh, not directly. This is what it means, who walks in his ways. You shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands, you'll be happy, and it will go well with you. Job wasn't the only one to question that, by the way. And Ecclesiastes questions it. If you do God's will everything go well with you? They all said it would. And don't forget they didn't know anything about beyond death. Job and the author of Ecclesiastes particularly say, hang on, look at experience, check it by the evidence. Here's all these people doing God's will and it's not going well with them. Eh? So there's no necessary link there. But that's what the psalmist says. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Then shall a man be blessed. Thus shall a man be blessed who fears Yahweh. Truly, says Job, chapter 28, verse 28, truly the fear of Yahweh, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil equals fear of the Lord, you see? Departing from evil, that's understanding. So fear that comes from Yahweh is actually fear of our capacity to get it wrong, to sin, to walk in the wrong direction, to ignore the grace that God has given us and the light and just live our life as though it didn't come for us. Here's the first letter of John, which is taking us into the Christian world a bit. There's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. Whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. Now, we don't want to presume we've reached perfection in love, because we haven't. There's a lot of journeying yet to go. But it's at least a lovely statement saying the goal of our life is love. So I think, well, I'll read what I've written there. Prior to Jesus, it's understandable that God was at times seen as an object of fear. In all religions, and some of them it's dreadful. Judaism wasn't as bad as many of the contemporary. You know, they used to kill their kids and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But from religious, gods were angry and gods were hungry and gods were jealous and gods were whatever. So people, us poor little human beings wandering around the world, wanted to make sure God was on our side. So we've got all this magic going on. So God being an object of fear was normal. The expression fear of Yahweh, however, focuses more radically on a gift received from God, who is the source of all wisdom, a sense of the sacred at the heart of the world, a sense that inspires awe and wonder and an openness to mystery. It's this reverence that expands our experience of the everyday. Relying on God and putting our trust in God, we have the courage to explore experience, knowing that however easy or hard our circumstances may be, God, who has chosen us as his own, is at the heart of the world that he transcends. And that's all the best I can put it, and that's really a gift given to every single human being in our world. And it's up to the Jews in their world, as they came to see it when they went to Babylon, their mission. And that mission was picked up extraordinarily beautifully by Jesus. And what a redemption that was, what a reform that was, because Jesus enabled the disciples. They didn't all pick it up. But Paul did, and Barnabas did, and Stephen did, and a lot did. It broke them free from their Jewish tribal laws. What they could eat, what they could sacrifice, and all that stuff. That was nothing wrong with it, but identified them as against other people by their tribal customs. Now, you wouldn't think that because there's still people following them, but Jesus did liberate us from all that, and Paul was delighted with it. Sought, died a Jew, loved Judaism, sought it as best, and dared to live it the way Jesus lived it. Paul died a Jew, of course, so did Jesus. That didn't change religions. But he lived Judaism as Jesus lived it, with great freedom. And, of course, that's why it exploded into the Roman Greek world, because it was free of all that. All you had to do to be a Christian was love. Well, that's pretty attractive. And if you love, of course, Augustine wasn't the only one to say it. He says, love and do what you will, meaning do what you choose. If you love, you're going to make wonderful choices. So do it. Doesn't mean love and you can do anything. It's unloving. So let me then continue with the text. So having said, as for you, fear God. That's what it just said. Take the divine seriously, take the sacred seriously, live in the wonder of the mystery of that, and see it in everybody, see it in yourself, see it in the world, dare the mystery, enjoy it, but don't let yourself be superficial and discard this wonder of the sacred and the divine at the heart of our world. Having said that, he then continues. If you see in a province, the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and right, don't be amazed at the matter. For the arrogant official is watched by a more arrogant one, and there are yet more arrogant ones over them. The advantage of the land is in its provision. That is, if the field is cultivated for its provision, for what it provides, the lover of money won't be satisfied with money, nor the lover of wealth with gain. This also is emptiness and pointless. He's talking about people who buy up land. I think it's happening in the Hunter Valley now, isn't it? Buying up land that's wonderful for its produce and then fracture the earth and do all this stuff to get whatever gases and that. So greed can destroy our world. The lover of money won't be satisfied. When goods increase, those who consume them increase. But what accomplishments do those who possess it have, except what their eyes see? Sweet is the sleep of labourers. Lovely country folk working on the farm, and they sleep like a log. Whether they eat little or much, but the surfeit of the rich will not let them sleep. Or work out how they can grab some more money tomorrow. There is a grievous ill that I've observed under the sun, he says. Riches were hoarded by their owners to their hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. Though they are parents of children, they have nothing in their hands. As they came from their mother's womb, so shall they go again, naked as they came. They won't take anything for all their toil. All the toil which they make will carry away with their hands. Yes, that is a grievous ill. Just as they came, so shall they go. And what gain do they have from toiling for the wind? Besides, all their days they eat in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and resentment. Then he goes on. And he said this three times already, so getting the point, I hope. This is what I've seen to be good. He hasn't seen much good, but he has seen this. It's fitting to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun during the few days of life that God has given us. For this is our apportioned lot. Indeed, God has enabled all to whom he's given wealth and possession to enjoy them and to accept their allotted portion and find enjoyment in their toil. This is God's gift. For they'll scarcely brood over the days of their lives because God keeps them occupied with the joy of their heart. So he seems to be telling me, if you live in the present moment and live lovingly in it and get all the joy you can from it. If you don't get joy, well, wear it, but don't let it stop you enjoying the moment. I think he's saying that. Kohelet is advising us not to focus in an unhealthy way on the negatives, for if we do so, we won't notice or relish the positives. We must ensure that we're free to accept and enjoy the pleasures that come our way. God's made it possible for us to forget the negatives, including the ultimate meaninglessness of our ephemeral lives, by giving us an instinct for enjoyment. Indulge it and accept God's gift of love. And then he continues. There's an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy upon humankind. Those to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honour, so that they lack nothing of all they desire, yet God doesn't enable them to enjoy these things, a stranger enjoys them. There's no point in this, which is another way of saying vanity. It's a grievous ill. Even if a man begets 100 children, Oh, no, he'd have many of those. Even if a man begets 100 children and live many years, however many years he may live, if he does not enjoy life's good things, and if he has no burial site, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For he comes into life with no good reason, and he goes into darkness, and in darkness his name is lost. Even the one who has not seen the sun or known it has more repose than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the same place. All human toil is for the mouth, yet the appetite is not satisfied. The mouth he's talking about is the mouth of Sheol, Hades. When we die, we go down there and the gods of the underworld, that was a Greek idea, he hasn't got that idea, but they kind of drink you. Isaiah says in 5:14, Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opens its mouth beyond measure, enjoying gobbling up the dead. Here's Proverbs 27:20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, and human eyes are never satisfied. The oppressors have the same greedy appetite, and the wise are gobbled up along with the food. And he concludes, for what advantage have the wise over fools? What good does it do the poor person to know how to get along with living? Better what the eye sees than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity, a chasing after wind.